It is the Burt Cohen Show. For people like Willard Romney, oh yeah, Mitt Romney, he's better known as Mitt Romney, and a lot of people are pushing on anyway, despite the election that happened in New Hampshire on January 10th, the New Hampshire primary. Now, of course, it's no great surprise that I am, yes, a Democrat from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, but here I'm very pleased to have as guest on the Burt Cohen Show somebody who knows a little bit more about the Republican Party, its former chair, Fergus Cullen, former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. Thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Well, thank you, Senator. I appreciate being here.
Well, sure. And I forget what years you were chair of the formerly grand old party.
Well, 2007, 2008. So for the last presidential cycle.
Oh, wow.
So the last time we had the First in the Nation primary, I was at the helm for that.
Wow, interesting. And as such, you had to stay neutral. You didn't have to stay neutral in this race because you're not chair. But did you support anyone in particular in the primary?
I ended up voting for John Huntsman. I only decided to do so on Sunday, right after seeing the last debate. I'm not anti-Romney. Frankly, right. I felt like he didn't need my vote. Romney didn't.
Right.
But I decided I would go with Huntsman in the end. He was a mainstream conservative. He wasn't angry. He focused on fiscal issues, not social issues. And I thought he showed political courage as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. It does seem to be that he was really a mainstream conservative. And one huge difference, as you can tell, Fergus, between Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, for that matter, which is upcoming on the 21st, is the social conservative factor. New Hampshire, tell us about how New Hampshire compares to the so-called Christian conservatives, the evangelicals in both Iowa and upcoming South Carolina, and what you think that may mean for the presidential candidates.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different electorate. Of course, Iowa is a caucus, so New Hampshire is a primary. Iowa's population is about 2.5 times larger than that of New Hampshire, and yet New Hampshire Republicans cast twice as many votes as participants
really?
In Iowa did.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, it's a broader electorate. Of course, independents are allowed to vote in the New Hampshire primary at either party. And because, in part, there is no contest on the Democratic side to speak of, nearly half of the electorate the other day was not Republicans, but registered independents. I think they were 40 or 44%, according to the exit polls.
Well, that is a very, very interesting question that those of us who are political wonks wonder about. I don't know if the data is in yet, whether or not how many independents picked up Republican ballots this time. In 2008, the last New Hampshire primary, a lot of the independents went in and picked up Democratic ballots. And that will make a big difference on New Hampshire's four electoral votes come November, whether or not the independents, who are certainly the majority, did you see a lot of them picking up? I mean, I wonder how one measures that, what percentage of the votes cast or whatever. Do you have any insight into that, Fergus?
Well, you know, New Hampshire is a swing state, as you know, in a general election. So part of why it's good, I think, for both parties in New Hampshire to have independents be able to vote is you have to demonstrate as a candidate an ability to not only attract support from the base of your own party, but also from the very swing voters who determine the outcome in general elections. It's part of why New Hampshire is just such a good test. There will be data on independents who pulled ballots. But, you know, regardless of how people are registered to vote, it's really more important to think of how do they think of themselves. Do they think of themselves as a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent? You know, 40% of people in New Hampshire are registered as independent. I bet a significantly higher percentage thinks of themselves as independent. I vote for the person, not for the party.
Well, I wonder how many of the independents, for example, you know, how many may have voted for Barack Obama in New Hampshire or Hillary Clinton in 2008, but this time decided to go probably for either Romney or Huntsman, the two relatively mainstream Republicans. Do you have any sense of that, Fergus?
Well, the exit polling data was very interesting. You know, I think there is a certain disappointment in the Obama administration. I say that not as a partisan. I say it as an objective fact.
Absolutely.
I think it's true even among Democrats. Look, a lot of them may have been Ron Paul voters. You know, I try and remind my Republican friends, you know, Ron Paul got 22%. That's a very impressive number. I had expected him to about double his vote share from 4 years ago. In fact, he tripled his vote share from 4 years ago. And look, I tell all my Republican friends, think of a Ron Paul voter as a swing voter in a general election. They are certainly not loyal Republicans. They are certainly not straight ticket voting Republicans. You hope that they'll come out and support the Republican candidate for president and down ballot races, but do not assume that they will do so at all. That would be a mistake.
We are talking with Fergus Cullen, former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. And, you know, there's so many different factors as to what happens next. Ron Paul, let's focus on him for a while. He is, and as you said, a lot of Democrats, a lot of liberals, and I think, yes, we can use that word again. It's not such a bad word, although I think the original tainting of the word liberal was with that ad against Mike Dukakis, where they had the revolving door letting what's-his-name out of jail. And that, you know, that struck as liberal, and then liberal with fiscal policy, spending too much. But anyway, a lot of people on the left and right, probably especially in New Hampshire, were drawn to Ron Paul. And, you know, he's going forward. He did very well, somewhere 22-23%. That's interesting that he tripled his vote from last time. Last time he was seen a bit more fringe. He hasn't changed at all. As he said, he hasn't changed. It's the people who have come around for that. And he is...
Well,
go ahead.
You know, yes and no. I mean, one thing that had changed is they had a much more professional operation than sort of the ragtag event that they had 4 years ago. Keep in mind that his son, Rand Paul, of course, was elected to the U.S. Senate a year ago after winning a very competitive primary and then winning in a competitive state. So he had a lot more experienced staffers, you know, people who got their training in Kentucky and then went national. So he also had, of course, well-funded. He was a well-funded candidate. His paid advertising in New Hampshire, I haven't seen final numbers, but he probably was number one or number two in terms of his paid advertising. And Ron Paul's paid ads made him very mainstream. You know, if the only information you had about Ron Paul was what you saw in the paid ads, you'd say, hey, this guy is pretty common sense. Now, here's the problem, of course, Bert. Ron Paul is very much out of the mainstream of the Republican Party on a lot of issues. He is prone to conspiracy theories, like having said the CIA is running everything, for example. And a lot of a disproportionate number of his supporters also buy into a number of conspiracy theories. Now, why did no one point that out in the primary? It's because he was not a spoiler. His vote share was not coming out of the hide of any other one candidate. If Ron Paul had, you know, tragically passed away of a heart attack a week before the election, what would have happened to his vote? I think half of it would have stayed home and the other half would have scattered across the rest of the field. So there was no political motivation for any of the other candidates to go in and set the record straight to balance the scales in terms of the information voters had about Ron Paul.
Yeah, he did have very, very effective ads. In fact, I wonder who produced those ads. They really, I think, touched the nerve of a lot of people in New Hampshire, and it certainly was a different image, anyway, of Ron Paul than we had in 2008. Why is it, do you think, Fergus, that Ron Paul was so incredibly ignored, like specifically intentionally ignored, not only by the mainstream media, but by the establishment Republican Party? Is it because he's dangerous, or why was he so ignored?
Well, I mean, the New Hampshire Union Leader, which, you know, whether you want to call them establishment or not is another question, they did not ignore Ron Paul. In fact, specifically, they called him dangerous. And you saw on election night Ron Paul embracing that label. Yes, we're dangerous to the status quo. Ron Paul went out of his way to tweak the union leader and saying, you know, thank you for not endorsing me. You know, I think that a lot of his followers wear the attacks as a badge of honor. I get that. I respect that. You know, he was 4 years ago, he really was treated as something of a pariah. This time around, he was invited to give addresses at Lincoln Day dinners and other Republican events, in part because local organizers knew he has a very loyal following. They would show up and they would write a check.
Well, money does factor. Big surprise. It's amazing how much money factors into this thing. I want to stay with Ron Paul a little bit about, you know, that thing, what he talked about on that speech on election night, when he talked about the cause of liberty, that it's not so much about him, Ron Paul, whereas I think the perception is, certainly on my part, that Mitt Romney is all about Mitt Romney more than anything else. Now, you may disagree with me on that. We can get to that later. But he is clearly about the cause of liberty. And I wonder how much that resonates. Nobody, not Barack Obama, nobody else in either party talks about, for example, the Patriot Act, which I would think, knowing New Hampshire, certainly as I do, and I would think, as you know, Fergus, that people don't like the Patriot Act, the idea that there can be sneak and peek, that the government can go in and look at our, you know, what we're looking at on the internet, you know, look at our emails and things like that. I wonder how this, do you think, cut it in New Hampshire, and do you think we'll cut it in South Carolina?
Well, I saw Ron Paul a week ago Friday at University of New Hampshire. He had sort of a town hall meeting style event there. Now, UNH is out of session. The students were not there. The campus was empty, but that hall was not empty. There were nearly 500 people there, disproportionately young. When he got his biggest applause line for when he talked about non-intervention or isolationist views, bringing troops back home from where they are deployed overseas. You know, this was certainly an anti-war crowd. Now, listen, you know, there are plenty of people who disagree about foreign affairs, but Ron Paul is out there saying, I'm totally fine with Iran becoming a nuclear power. That is a view that is extraordinarily outside of the mainstream of the Republican Party. And yet, you know, he's out there advocating it. And again, no one really called him on it this whole process. Now, I do expect he's going to continue to roll along, picking up 15% to 20% of the votes in state after state. There's no motivation for him to leave. He's not expecting to be president of the United States. He's running as an advocate, and he's getting somewhere with that.
Well, and I'm sure the students also cared very much about ending the unbelievably insane and damage-causing drug war. It's nice that I can express my opinions on this. You know, the drug war has just, it's failed miserably. Nobody else is talking about that. It's destroyed families. It's kept drugs out of control. It's put a lot of people in jail, really hurt, you know, innocent family members. Nobody else is talking about that. I wonder how that played in New Hampshire. I suspect it played pretty well, and how you think it will play in the future. You know, I've been curious what the people of New Hampshire, independents, Republicans, all of us, think about the drug war, and I wonder how much of a vote it was, a referendum on that issue. What's your sense on that, Fergus?
Well, I don't think it was much. I mean, you know, most people in New Hampshire are not users of illegal drugs, even if they think that they would be okay to decriminalize, you know, pot possession and things like that. I mean, there are certainly the pro-legalization crowd was obviously disproportionately with Ron Paul. But again, Bert, that is a very outside the mainstream view of the Republican Party. You know, we're going to have a gubernatorial primary coming up, and I'm sure that all the candidates are going to be law and order Republicans on the issue of legalization.
Right.
You know, so it's not a pressing priority. Okay, people are concerned about jobs and the economy. Maybe they're concerned about the wars. Maybe they're concerned about health care. But, you know, for a person to be running for president on a platform based on drug legalization, they are not talking about an issue that most voters consider one of their top three.
for sure. But I did find, I mean, no question about that. It's not something that motivates a whole heck of a lot of people to get out of their house, especially in bad weather. Although New Hampshire had incredibly great weather. Unlike our, I'll never forget 1984 when the weather couldn't have been worse. It was cold, drenching, precipitation. This time it was easy. I thought it was interesting. We're talking to Fergus Cullen, former chair of the Republican Party in New Hampshire. When CNN had a test group down in South Carolina watching Ron Paul give his speech, each of them had meters, very, very simple meters. You know, you move it up if you like what he says, you move it down if you don't like what it says. I was watching when Ron Paul specifically said about bring them home. He wanted to stop the U.S. from being this imperialist military power, wasting our money on all these overseas wars that are, you know, fabulous for the weapons contractors, but, you know, hurt the economy and cause, you know, needless deaths and losses of limbs. I thought it was, I wanted to see specifically how people in South Carolina felt when he said, bring them home. And it appeared from what I saw. Now, granted, it was a small focus group, but it seemed like most of them, it resonated, bring them home. How do you see that playing in the upcoming election and as well as the convention?
Well, this is very interesting because the ground, the political ground, has shifted a large amount on this issue since 4 years ago. Remember, 4 years ago, Republican candidates were trying to outdo each other in terms of their support for the surge in Iraq. Right. That was the politically right place to be.
Right.
But now, even among Republicans, skepticism about continued U.S. involvement militarily overseas, specifically in Afghanistan and Iraq, has become a very mainstream view in the Republican Party. Now, Ron Paul, I think, you know, deserves credit, if you will, for having been raising those issues 4 years ago, and the party has moved in his direction on that issue. Look, there's another candidate, John Huntsman, who basically had a similar view, and so why did he not cut through enough the way Ron Paul did? I think part of it is that John Huntsman wasn't clear enough in drawing bright, sharp distinctions between himself and other candidates, including making it clear on the war issue that he was saying enough is enough. It's time to declare victory, count our accomplishments, and come home. He didn't say anything as clear as that the entire campaign. I saw him out on the stump more than six times over the course of the year. And on this issue, especially early on, he was frankly too subtle, too vague.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't be sure in listening to him what his position was on it, even though it is what I just described. He was in favor of saying enough is enough.
Interesting. And Huntsman is staying in the hunt, as it were. If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, we are talking with Fergus Cullen, former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. We have a convention. I don't know when the Republican convention is or where it is, but I suspect you know. How my guess would be that Ron Paul, yeah, clearly he knows he's not going to be in the White House, except unless he's invited by somebody, which frankly I doubt even that. How much of a force do you think he will be at the Republican convention? His cause of liberty. How much of an important player will Ron Paul be? I'm sure that's his goal.
Well, he's going to get a bunch of delegates. I suspect in the end of this process, the Republican Party is going to nominate Mitt Romney,
oh, yeah,
and that Ron Paul will probably have the second highest number of delegates. So it'll be very interesting at, you know, a national convention. You've been to them. I'm sure it's the same on the Democratic side. They tend to be, you know, the establishment of the establishment. And then there'll be 20 or 30% of the delegates running around to her with Ron Paul, and they'll really not have a whole lot in common. That should be entertaining to watch. But, you know, here in New Hampshire, for example, Ron Paul, again, he got 22, 23% of the vote. In terms of grassroots activists, that means that they're sort of halfway to a majority, if you will. Now, in other states, there's been a huge contention between the Ron Paul followers and sort of the establishment Republicans.
Right.
In New Hampshire, it has not been as pronounced. There have not been pitched battles. I think in part because we have a 400-person legislature. And if you are excited about Ron Paul's views and you're motivated to get involved in public life and civic life and public service, you can run for office and you can win. You don't need to be doing it sort of, we have to take over the establishment first in order to achieve that. in our legislature. Ron Paul had something like 25 or 30 endorsements from legislators who, you know, are of his mind view, his worldview, rather. And, you know, so that's been sort of an interesting quirk in how it plays out in New Hampshire versus other parts of the country.
Well, what's going to happen? I mean, of course, we don't have a crystal ball, but we can guess about the Republican convention. And there is the party platform, which is frankly generally ignored on both parties after it's written. But there's often a fight for what is in the platform, what the party stands for. I would think that would be a place where the Ron Paul faction would push really hard. I wonder if they'll be able to get any of his, you know, anti-Patriot Act, concerns about the Federal Reserve, the war profiteering. I wonder, I mean, as you say, it's so counter to the establishment, which will obviously be a huge majority at the convention. What do you see happening with platform? Will any of that stuff make it in there? Will there be big platform battles about that, like in conventions of old?
There may be, but, you know, I will say, as chairman, I used to get frustrated by this because there are a certain number of activists who care very, very much about phrases and wording and where you place the comma in the platform. And to me, it's a tempest in a teapot. You know, as you just said, usually they aren't read after the convention. Certainly swing voters aren't paying close attention to that kind of thing.
For sure.
And I would be okay with it if that same group of activists put as much energy into helping candidates, helping Republicans win elections, as they do in meaningless, oftentimes, platform fights. You know, we're going to have a big pitch paddle over some resolution. Instead, and then when it comes time to actually, you know, knocking on doors and persuading swing voters to support your team instead of the other team, they're nowhere to be found. So, you know, that's a misplaced sense of priority, and I frankly find it very frustrating sometimes.
Well, it would be interesting, I think you would agree, Fergus, for example, just if, and I know it's not going to happen, but if there was part of the Republican national platform to be for, you know, personal liberty and against such invasive things as the Patriot Act, I would think that might actually be beneficial to the Republican Party, you know, to have that in there. But, you know, chances are it won't be in there. But I we've all seen activists on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, you know, almost fight to the death for inclusion in the party platform. And then, you know, where does it go?
Yeah, I just think, again, you know, if folks would put the same amount of energy into trying to help like-minded people win elections, they'd be more effective. But, you know, look, it's politics and everyone's motivated for different reasons. And that's
right.
Okay.
Absolutely. And we've talked a bit about the party establishment. And we mentioned the formerly known as Manchester Union leader, the New Hampshire Union leader. I don't know if you were able to contact Joe McQuaid the day after the election at all, but I have wondered how massive his headache must have been. The reason I say that is because Joe McQuaid wrote the editorial endorsing Newt Gingrich. Does anybody still remember Newt Gingrich? They endorsed Newt Gingrich. What was said about the power of the union leader? He came in a distant fourth in this thing. What does it say about that?
In fact, now they've counted up the final ballots, it looks like he finished fifth, narrowly edged by Rick Santorum. Well, you know, first of all, I do, you know, I'm an editorial page columnist with the union leader. It's my privilege to be a guest of the paper. I'm not a member of their staff. I'm not a member of their editorial board. I'm not paid for my column there. So I can say this as an observer. I do think the union leader had a very big impact on this race. They endorsed Newt Gingrich on November 27th. And it really framed the last month of the campaign. Suddenly, Newt Gingrich was considered, after several weeks, the challenger to Mitt Romney, the alternative to Mitt Romney, where so many other candidates had failed. That being said, Bert, Newt Gingrich really did not help the paper help him. First of all, they do the endorsement, and he doesn't show up here for 2.5 weeks. Contrast this with John McCain, who showed up the next day to do the tour and do a thank you and hold up the newspaper. So you know, he squandered that.
Wow.
In fact, in the entire month of December, Bert, Newt Gingrich made two trips to New Hampshire. One of them was a very good one. Again, I'm saying it was belated. It was late. It was 2.5 weeks after the endorsement. But, you know, he did that Lincoln Douglas with John Huntsman at St. Anselm.
Right.
He did a town hall meeting at Windham High School, which had 1,000 people. At that point, the biggest event that any candidate, including Mitt Romney, had in the entire campaign in New Hampshire. And then his only other visit was a drive-by where he picked up the endorsement of the Speaker of the New Hampshire House, Bill O'Brien, at an event where hardly anyone saw him. There was certainly not a lot of public access on that event. I noticed on Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, the union leader did not exactly bang the drum for Newt Gingrich the way you might have expected. They were not putting an exclamation point on that endorsement. I think it was very telling. I think that fundamentally they're probably disappointed that Gingrich didn't do enough. I think there are going to be a lot of questions asked about why didn't he campaign more aggressively here. It turned out that the union leader was doing more to help Newt Gingrich win in New Hampshire than Newt Gingrich was doing himself.
That is fascinating. I hadn't picked up on that, but you're right. You would think, anybody who knows New Hampshire politics, even a little bit, would know that if you get the paper's endorsement, you show up either that day or the next day and you do a big, thing about it. But he didn't do that. That's really odd. That does not speak well of his campaign. And yet he's going on, and we are moving on to South Carolina, which is a much bigger state. Traditionally, it's what we've known about South Carolina is a lot of evangelists, a lot of Tea Party people. But according to what I've looked at so far, there's a lot of new people, especially in the coastal area. What do we know about South Carolina and how? I was frankly a little bit surprised that Newt Gingrich is going on, but tell us about South Carolina and specifically Newt Gingrich's role there. He's been bashing Romney quite a bit.
Yeah, Newt Gingrich, well, first of all, he survived New Hampshire. He sort of battled it out with Rick Santorum, no clear winner between the two of them. This is really good news for Mitt Romney, let's not forget.
Absolutely.
He gets the benefit. Plus, you got Rick Perry pretending that he's still a candidate in South Carolina. So, the three candidates running to Mitt Romney's right, if you will, Gingrich, Santorum, and Perry, all still alive, if only for another week or so. So splintering the opposition, that's really helpful. Yeah. But you're right, the South Carolina electorate around the Charleston area, becoming increasingly, let's not call it moderate, but certainly not as a hardcore conservative as inland areas are. You get a lot of retirees, probably from northern states, who are settling in the coastal area.
Right.
John McCain, let's remember, won South Carolina last time, I think with about 37% of the vote. He was obviously not your hard right candidate. So that bodes fairly well for Mitt Romney, but really all he has to do is survive there. And, and remember also there's Jim DeMint. DeMint is the U.S. Senator from South Carolina. He is arguably one of the two or three most conservative members of the United States Senate. He is the proponent of what I call DeMintism. He was quoted a couple of years ago saying, "I would rather have 30 members of the Republican caucus who actually believe in something than to have a majority of 55 who don't." Now, that's the kind of purist language. We'd rather lose votes 70 to 30, but feel like we were right and pure, than actually, get anything accomplished and done. And Jim DeMint probably represents about the political center of the Republican Party in South Carolina. So, very different electorate than here in New Hampshire.
And what has Mr. DeMint had to say about the candidates?
He's neutral. I mean, that's interesting. We saw him wading into primaries in the U.S. Senate across the country last time, often at odds with the Republican Senatorial Committee. For example, Jim DeMint got behind Marco Rubio in Florida when the Senatorial Committee was supporting Charlie Crist. Huge mistake on the part of the Senatorial Committee. But
yeah.
Jim DeMint was often right on those kinds of primaries. He got a couple of them wrong, Nevada being one of them, for example. I think he was wrong on Colorado. But he's a force to be reckoned with. Now, isn't it interesting that in his own state, in the presidential primary, he decided to stay neutral? I suspect maybe he really wanted to be with Rick Perry, but as Rick Perry discredited himself, no one was going to waste their political capital on him.
Interesting. Yes, yeah, South Carolina, it's got an amazing political history if you look back on it. And I don't think there's any question about Jim DeMint being right. He is certainly right, rather far right. But I guess, it depends on your point of view. I'm looking at it here from Yankeedom. And we are talking, if you just tuned in, with Fergus Cullen, who knows a thing or two about the Republican Party and what's going to happen with that. We talked a little bit about Rick Perry. His terminology talking about Bain Capital, the company that Mitt Romney, the obvious nominee, is most closely associated with, as being vultures, as having like a vulture circling in the sky, looking, waiting for sick companies, going in and then ripping them apart and tossing out their employees. And now you have this 27-minute video that the Democratic Party had nothing to do with, Newt Gingrich's, or his super PAC, has done all on his own, talking about the evils and the rapaciousness of Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's company. Tell it, what is Rick Perry doing? Is he just doesn't care and doesn't mind bringing the party down in flames with him?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of recklessness going on here. You know, I mean, a dangerous thing in politics is a candidate with nothing to lose.
Hmm.
Gingrich fits in that category. So does Rick Perry. And they both have enough money that, in a grudge maybe, that they're willing to do something. It's very painful for me as a partisan Republican to see other Republicans making arguments that Democrats would typically make. Now, the only upside that I can see is we sort of knew this argument was going to come from the Obama campaign down the road. So there's some benefit, I think, to taking care of it, hashing it out, vetting the issue now so that in October voters are, you know, aware of it. We've sort of had that conversation already, and maybe it's less effective. But of course, we're going to see Democratic ads this year showing other Republicans attacking Mitt Romney on his personal success. And, you know, I just don't like it when Republicans buy into these class warfare arguments that we would expect from the left.
Well, I wouldn't call it class warfare, but of course, being a partisan Democrat, I love it. What do you expect? But, you know, I think you hit on something here that may be very, very important. You know, the American attention span, let's face it, people get tired of issues really, really quickly. You know, something is old news if it's a week or two old. And as you say, you know, pointing out the record of Bain Capital, you know, here it is January, and we got almost a whole year to go. People are going to be tired of that issue. Oh, I've heard that before. So in a way, maybe Perry and Gingrich may be, you know, helping out. They're also certainly helping out by staying in the race. I mean, I'm sure Mitt Romney, if he had nothing else to smile about, he would be smiling because these guys have their, you know, their followings, and they're guaranteeing his win, really, in South Carolina. I mean, neither one of those guys can possibly imagine that they're going to beat Mitt Romney here. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, I do think he benefits from, you know, a divided field. But Mitt Romney's been more than just lucky in this campaign, Bert. He's also created his own luck. They've run a remarkably good campaign.
No doubt.
Made almost no mistakes.
True.
He worked in New Hampshire not just hard for the last year, but for the last 6 years.
Yep.
And, you know, so a lot of what's coming together, you know, the knock on Republicans is that we have this big fight, and then we do what we always were going to do, which is nominate the next guy in line.
Right.
And that does seem to be the way this thing is going this year.
Yeah, it does seem to be. But what about this? This issue itself, you know, the Mitt Romney people themselves, who I cannot possibly argue, they've run a stellar campaign, a brilliant campaign, haven't made any mistakes that I have seen. He's clearly going to be the nominee of the party, you know, and I could say unless he makes some big mistake, but he's not going to. I mean, it's just he's not going to make any mistakes. He's had so many years to be really, really good at this thing here. But I find it interesting. What's going to be an interesting political dynamic over the next few months is this discussion about unfettered capitalism, you know, just creative destruction, as has been called. And, you know, the fact that, you know, this is the way capitalism is. Now, when Mitt Romney said he liked to fire people, you and I know he didn't mean he likes to fire people. He likes to have the ability to change insurance companies, for example, and make that consumer choice, as we all do. And there I am defending him on that. But the fact is that that Bain Company did, you know, it was one of those private equity firms that like to, you know, scout about. I think, frankly, what Rick Perry is saying is true. It's got some truth to it. But Romney is being brilliant in talking about the politics of resentment, you know, because Americans do not hate rich people, never have. Americans all want to be rich themselves. That's one of the things about the very identity of Americans, left and right. I wonder how this resentment thing is playing. Could it, I mean, if they put, you know, if they define it as they've started to define it as good old American free market capitalism versus evil European Marxist socialism, how do you see that playing out?
Well, look, I really resent the politics of envy, the politics of class warfare. And I resent it when Barack Obama talks about it, and I resent it especially when Republicans are at it. I mean, Mitt Romney, you know, say what you like about him, this is an example of earned success. Okay, yes, he had opportunities in life, that he came from a family that gave him plenty of opportunities, but the whole, you know, Bain Capital, this guy has gone from one success to another. He is clearly a talented, accomplished person. You could disagree with him on some of his policy positions if you want. But, you know, I think we'd all like to have our own kids grow up to have the kind of success in life that Mitt Romney has achieved. And attacking that, especially by Republicans, is really, I think, you know, terribly unfortunate and says a lot more about the people making those attacks than it does about Mitt Romney.
Well, it does bring up the question, you know, we have the whole Occupy Wall Street thing, which was at first ignored, and now it's caught on with a lot of people, and people get 99%. Now, here you have a classic case of Mitt Romney. He's in the 0.1%, if not, you know, greater than that, and there's the 99%. You know, to call out the politics of envy, I think that's very smart politics to define it that way, but you know, it's also true, and frankly, as Newt Gingrich is saying, that, you know, there's got to be, you know, capitalism, it should not be totally rapacious. We, the 99%, you know, can't be just at mercy of the, you know, aristocratic 1%. And, you know, a lot of people have been pointing out that there's been this, you know, shift in wealth in America for the last couple of decades since Ronald Reagan started it off, that more, I mean, there's just this tremendous shift in destruction of the middle class, and the middle class has been largely wiped out. There's fewer and fewer middle class people, and more people who are really hurting, who through no fault of their own, you know, they've worked hard. Don't you think this can hurt Romney in the general election?
No, I don't think so. He's running against an incumbent. I mean, it is a potential strength. It's also a potential vulnerability. I think he's handled it actually very well. You know, one of the things that establishment Republicans or party professionals, like me, if you will, feel confident about Mitt Romney is that they've run such a competent campaign that they haven't been caught napping on anything. You know, this is a big difference from the John McCain campaign. Part of his spontaneity was his charm, part of his charm was his spontaneity,
right.
But it also led to things like suspending the campaign in September during the banking crisis last time around, you know, after which the entire campaign really unraveled.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a button-down operation. You know, I think that he should wear his success as a badge of honor. You know, he's obviously been running a campaign that is aimed at the middle class. He's not talking about tax cuts for the wealthy. I personally would like to see Romney defend talented, successful people who create jobs maybe a little more vigorously than he has.
Create jobs. Well, that's one big difference here is create jobs. Now, here we're coming into the reality that you are a Republican. I am a Democrat. I think creating jobs is extremely important. And, you know, a lot of rapacious capitalism cares nothing. I mean, it's a fact, doesn't care about creating jobs. In fact, if you destroy jobs, that's good for the bottom line oftentimes. I mean, it is about the bottom line. And then there is the role of government maybe to, you know, have a little bit of controls over capitalism. But if the Republican Party, is able to define it as a fight between, you know, good old American patriotic capitalism and, you know, evil Marxist socialism, guess what? Which side wins? And I think that's an interesting point now that is going to be very, very difficult for President Obama to play because there is the 99%, and a lot of people can understand that. But, you know, nobody's against capitalism per se. I just don't.
I disagree, Bert. I mean, look, the Occupy protesters, I think, are very much against capitalism.
Oh,
I don't think there's much question about that.
Oh, I completely disagree. They're not against, I suppose there's elements of them, you know, that maybe, I mean, there's elements of the Republican Party that I'm sure you'd like to just, you know, do away with as well. But, you know, we're all capitalists here. We're all in favor of that. We just wanted to have a level playing field, and the playing field has not been level. It's been tilted very much toward the wealthiest among us. You know, the government has been owned lock, stock, and barrel by the, you know, top 1%. Let's face it, you know, you look at members of Congress, and I think it's smart for President Obama to be running against Congress because, as you know, Congress is very unpopular, even though there's a few Democrats in there. But, you know, this issue about a level playing field. But I digress here. Let's hear more from you on that, Fergus.
Well, I just think that the Occupy movement is one that should be mocked and scorned by Republicans. You know, look, I mean, it's amorphous. I mean, it does seem to be one that is resentful of other people. You know, let's forgive us all of our debts. Look, you know, a lot of us who have been paying our mortgages and didn't buy more house than we can afford really are resentful when other people walk away from their obligations. And, you know, the Occupy movement, again, seems to think that everyone is entitled to everything and some rich guy ought to pay for it all. And I just think that view is well outside of the mainstream.
Well, I think that the view that you just expressed, quite frankly, is well outside the mainstream. But it's a good narrative. It's a simple narrative. People like things simple. It's an easy explanation. And it probably can work for the Republicans this time around. And it does put Barack Obama in a very, very difficult situation because a lot of people, more than I would have guessed, quite frankly, quite honestly, identify with Occupy Wall Street. I've been surprised at how many older women, for example, I see them wearing 99% buttons, and they've gone down to the Occupy Wall Street thing to show their support because they realize that things have changed in America. You know, it's not nearly as much of a level playing field as it used to be. The disparity between, you know, the lowest paid employee and the highest paid employee, It's just gotten out of hand. I think, you know, to say that the Occupy Wall Street people are against capitalism, yeah, it's a good narrative. It's not at all true. I suppose, again, there may be elements of that. There's always, you know, things like the Spartacist Communist League, whatever. But the vast majority, I'd probably say the 99% of the 99%, is not against capitalism. These are people who have lost their jobs in this economy that's been tilted so badly and that frankly caused this destruction right now. I mean, what caused the meltdown in 2008? It's largely the bailouts of these huge entities, which Barack Obama was just as guilty of. But I don't know. The question is not what's right or what's wrong, obviously, in the election. It's what resonates. And I think you may be onto something here about resonating. The people get defensive. You know, people oftentimes have traditionally voted against their own interests, which is why Republicans have done so well through the years with the formerly middle class. But getting back to a little bit of the, you know, just political aspects of it, we have South Carolina coming up. And if you just tuned in, my guest today is Fergus Cullen, former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. Bert Cohen here. Do you think is it likely that the non-Romney will get more votes or a higher percentage, perhaps, than Romney in South Carolina? Not that it'll make any difference, because Romney's clearly going to win.
You mean, will Romney break 50% of the vote?
He won't get 50% of the vote, right.
You know, it's kind of interesting. The person who holds the record in New Hampshire for largest margin of victory on the Republican side in a contested New Hampshire primary was Ronald Reagan back in 1980. He won that primary by 27 points. And, you know, we think of Ronald Reagan as this guy who, you know, every single Republican loved and, you know, who united the party. Still, more than half of voters in New Hampshire voted against Ronald Reagan. He was no better than second choice for the majority of Republican primary voters, even when he was winning New Hampshire, setting a record for the largest margin of victory. So, you know, in a multi-candidate primary for Mitt Romney to be sitting at 35-40% of the vote, that suggests that he is broadly acceptable to Republicans across the spectrum. And you saw that in the exit polling data from New Hampshire the other day. You know, he was winning among people who are evangelical. He was winning among people who are more secular. He was winning across almost every income group. He was winning across almost every age group. He was winning among men. He was winning among women. If you had a positive feeling about the Tea Party, he was winning. If you had a negative feeling about the Tea Party or were neutral, he was doing just fine. So, you know, he's well within the mainstream of the Republican Party, and that's a great strength for him politically.
Well, that's an interesting point. I'm a little bit surprised that the evangelicals, the self-identified evangelicals and the, you know, Christian conservatives more voted for him than for other candidates. That's a very, very telling figure.
He won in terms of ideology. He was doing very well among people who identified themselves as very conservative, who identified themselves as somewhat conservative, as people who identified themselves as moderate. I mean, it was an incredibly broad base to his coalition. Now, here's something that I thought was interesting, Bert, from the exit polls. They asked people, would you describe yourself as a supporter of the Tea Party, as an opponent of the Tea Party, or are you sort of neutral on it? Among those voters who opposed the Tea Party, Republican primary voters who opposed the Tea Party, John Huntsman got 42% of the vote, almost triple what he did with the whole electorate. Now, that group of voters was relatively small. It was only 17% of the electorate. But that was the single group that John Huntsman did best in.
And what is the role of the Tea Party in the general election? They've certainly faded quite a bit. You know, again, how, you know, in America, issues fade really quickly. I mean, Occupy Wall Street is already starting to fade, but Tea Party is like way old news. But what do you think their influence is going to be? It's a very, very different Republican Party from what it used to be, even when Barry Goldwater was considered right wing. They're way...
I mean, a year ago, we were all talking about what the impact of the Tea Party was going to be, how they seemed to be, where the energy was of the Republican Party. You know, I'm a conservative, but I'm a pragmatic conservative.
Right.
A lot of the new activists who are drawn to the Tea Party are not pragmatic.
True.
They're very much purists.
Yeah.
And so they were looking for the perfect candidate instead of someone who was pretty good on their issues.
Right.
And as a result, they became paralyzed, Bert. They couldn't settle on who their perfect, pure candidate was. Maybe it was Rick Perry. Maybe it was Michelle Bachmann. Maybe it was going to be Herman Cain. They bounced from one person to another, and in the end, they had almost no measurable impact on the primary. I do think that Newt Gingrich, in the last month of the campaign, sparked by that union leader endorsement, succeeded where other candidates had failed in consolidating support from a lot of the Tea Party activists. So you saw people like former State Party Chairman Jack Kimball end up in the Newt Gingrich camp.
Mm-hmm.
But as we found out, that was a relatively small block of voters. Newt Gingrich ends up under 10% in single digits. Both he and Rick Santorum leave New Hampshire without having won even a single delegate.
Well, I wonder what happens with the self-identified supporters of the Tea Party in South Carolina. Is it Fergus, is it a higher percentage of the Republican electorate in South Carolina than it is in New Hampshire?
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. I can't point to data on that, but I believe that's the case. Again, you know, Jim DeMint is sort of emblematic of that. But there again, Mitt Romney has the benefit that not only do both, you know, in past years, historically, we've seen candidates forced out of the race after New Hampshire, they drop out.
Yeah.
This could be the first New Hampshire primary, you know, in a long, long time where everybody survives, nobody drops out.
It's surprising.
That's not going to last for very long.
No.
I mean, Rick Perry is clearly going to get politically executed this week, and good riddance to him. He's getting what he deserves. He was a terrible candidate, and I think that a lot of us should just see justice in his struggle. But, you know, Santorum and Gingrich both survived. One of them is going to come out of South Carolina alive, and the other one is probably not. And so, you know, Mitt Romney, again, gets splintered opposition. But that's sort of okay. Again, I find them broadly acceptable to most voters anyway. So, you know, this thing could be over very quickly.
And that's one thing that Mitt Romney has had as a strength, is being somewhat moderate. I mean, obviously, Gingrich thinks of him as the Massachusetts moderate. And I will say it's nice to see, as somebody who considers himself a pragmatic liberal, we've had purists in our party as well who cause trouble. Believe me, it's nice to see on your side for a change. My goodness, I mean, looking for the perfect candidate, the purist, you know. As somebody said, don't let the good be the enemy of the perfect, or the perfect be the enemy of the good, I should say. It often happens in both parties. Now, again, we're talking to Fergus Cullen, former chair of the Republican Party, Burke Cohen here. We haven't heard from the people of Massachusetts yet. Why did Mitt Romney not run for a second term? Now, I had heard it was because the numbers showed he wasn't going to win. But what do you know about that? Why didn't he run for a second term?
Well, I mean, I think he's in a competitive state. I know plenty of people who worked in his governor's administration in office. He was interested in running for president. Yeah. I believe he could have been reelected in 2006, but he expected to leave that position. And, as I was clearly already on running for president, there was some political risk that he would have been defeated. But I don't think he was embarrassed about his record or concerned that he was likely to be defeated. But look, he got elected in a tough state for a Republican to get elected. We just saw Deval Patrick get reelected by a wide margin in a tough year for Democrats nationally.
True.
And I think that's the reality of it. And I'm going to say it was the responsible thing to do, Bert. Look, he knew he was going to run for president. It's not a good thing to run for reelection, get reelected, and turn around the next day and start campaigning for president. I give him credit for not running if he felt like he had done what he had come to do and was ready to move on and take on another challenge.
It's going to be interesting to see. We, again, haven't really heard from the people of Massachusetts yet. I suspect there's going to be a lot of people from Massachusetts in the general election who talk about, not just Democrats, but people who talk about I've heard a lot of people in Massachusetts say, boy, he was not a good governor, not just Democrats. But we'll find out relatively soon. You know, I got to say, one of the things I've always loved about New Hampshire is the role of authenticity. And you've heard it again and again and again, Democrat and Republican. The average person, the independent, looks at you. They want to look you in the eye and tell if you're authentic, if you're for real. And, you know, there was that one famous person in some diner in Manchester, I think it was, who did that to Romney and said, nah, I'm not going to vote for him. He was considered. But what do you think the role of that, you know, that wonderful thing about retail politics about New Hampshire is, now that we've moved beyond New Hampshire, is that, you know, that sense of authenticity, is this candidate for real? Is that still going to be important as we go ahead?
Well, I do. I mean, you know, I think that one of the reasons why the New Hampshire primary works is that it exposes the fraud. You know, we saw Herman Cain hit 24% in one poll in New Hampshire. We saw Michelle Bachmann hit 18% in one poll. We saw Rick Perry hit 18% in one poll. Put them all together on election day, they got less than 1% of the vote. Again, I think that's justice. But, you know, for a while, anyone can hide behind 30-second ads.
Right.
Anyone apparently but Rick Perry can give a well-rehearsed 60-second answer in a debate or even in a town hall meeting. But eventually the fraud get exposed. Now, you know, I lived in Wolfboro for 6 years, and I can tell you that we used to see Mitt Romney, you know, from time to time in the community as a regular person. Right. I remember seeing him, you know, out riding his mountain bike with some of his kids or grandkids. You know, seeing him in the Bradley's hardware store downtown picking up something for the house. I remember one year walking in the 4th of July parade with young John Sununu and being surprised to see the governor of Massachusetts standing on the side of the parade route with his grandkids just watching the parade. That might have been 2003, 2004, something like that in that time frame. You know, so in terms of authenticity, I've got just no doubts about Mitt Romney in that category.
Well, the question is, I mean, I don't know if I ever met the guy, but I wonder where it goes from here. Here in New Hampshire, it's a beautiful thing, really, for both Democrats and Republicans to be able to do that. But is that over now? I mean, now is it all TV, you know, big bucks buys? Do the voters of South Carolina, will I still get to see that, do you think?
Well, I mean, the primaries are always changing. You know, back in 1964 on the Republican side, Henry Cabot Lodge won the Republican primary with write-in votes, and he was fueled at the time by an unprecedented statewide mailing. I think his campaign did three of them, and that was like the innovative cutting-edge technique. Back in 1980, when Ronald Reagan had that famous "I'm paying for this microphone" moment,
right.
You know, there wasn't cable TV in those days. There wasn't YouTube. And yet that moment still went viral, if you will, in the last weekend of the campaign.
Yeah, it did.
And in 1996, Pat Buchanan won the primary by 1.1%, the closest Republican primary we've ever had in New Hampshire. Mm. And he did that in almost the pre-internet era. They had a website, they had a little bit of email, yeah, but most people did not.
No.
So, you know, the primaries are always changing. What didn't change, Bert, is that the candidates on the Republican side who finished 1, 2, and 3, Mitt Romney, Ron Paul, and John Huntsman, were people who had authentic grassroots organizations who did a lot of campaigning among the people. The candidates who tried to just fake it were exposed and did poorly. Newt Gingrich crashes because he really didn't campaign much at all. Rick Santorum crashes because in the last 6 months of the campaign, he was hardly here. So, you know, I think that the lesson learned is do it the old-fashioned way, and you're likely to be met with success. Try and cut corners and skip actually meeting voters. And catch up with you.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing about New Hampshire, Democrat and Republican. Finally, and I get the sense your battery's dying here, Vice President Nikki Haley, Chris Christie, Mark Rubio, what's at stake here, and what do you think he's going to do?
Oh, well, I don't worry too much about that. I mean, I think the Republicans, frankly, learned some important lessons when they nominated
Sarah Palin 4 years ago. I think we're going to offer the country a much stronger vice presidential nominee this time. But, you know, that's going to be dictated by the circumstances come summer. It's really a political choice. I'm just very confident that we'll have somebody capable of actually serving if they are called upon to do so.
Well, Fergus Cullen, thank you very much for all that battery time. I appreciate that. I don't know where you've been driving around, but it's worked. The signal's been pretty good. Really appreciate your insight into this. And Fergus Cullen, former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party, thanks very much for your insights.
All right, Bert, real fun. Thank you for having me.
All right, thank you. I'd love to hear from you, Bert at BertCohen.com.